go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute past the hour, and we begin this Titanic Tuesday on the Horn, the 21st day of October 2014. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where you go to jump into the chat room. I'll be doing that momentarily as soon as the tired, weary old production computer gets done grinding and grinding and grinding and grinding. Yes. Because right now it's just kind of not possible. But anyway, yes, run on over. We had a great crowd in the chat room last night. Hope we will have something similar this evening. That's entirely up to you. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom. Also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, the groovy, hey, wow, what a wonderful word, new pop-out players. For your enjoyment. Of course, a reminder, if you're listening on some sort of mobile eye, something or another Android smart device, we recommend the apps from TuneIn and Stitcher, either of which work well as Ootunes Radio. Ootunes runs about $4.99 in the App Store, at least on the Apple side of things, I'm told, and works quite well. Also, of course, at the website, you will find the contribute page. Therein lies the PayPal interface, which is how we keep all of this going. And thanks go out this evening to Joan. Thank you very kindly, Joan. Joan got us started on fundraising this evening to the tune of 2/3 of our evening's fundraising goal. That means we've got only $50 to raise this evening to keep even. Now, a program note, no program tomorrow, no program Thursday. My sincere apologies, but it's a little operation here, and there's nobody really to put in place for fill-in purposes or whatever. So that means we will have no show tomorrow, no program on Thursday, and back, of course, for Friday on the front porch. So thank you very much, Joan, for helping us take care of a big chunk of this evening's fundraising. And hopefully folks will pop by and finish off the last 50 bucks, and or who knows, get us a little further down the road so that we won't be in some sort of desperate straits come Friday, which is a real bonus. early programming note coming in from Kate on the Front Range. Now on to another subject. There is no Ebola. Could we talk about something else? Even the 40 close folks to Mr. Duncan are no longer in quarantine. On to something else. How about a seminar on a famous African-Egyptian, Hypatia, the woman whose library got burned in Alexandria? Yeah, there is Hypatia. And there is indeed. Of course, she was torn to shreds by the peace-loving followers of Christ Jesus. And you know, by that time, the library in Alexandria, there wasn't much left of it, but what was left represented the remainder of classical wisdom in the ancient world, and they kind of took care of that, too, because you can't have all that learning, you know. But it is. It really is. It's Titanic Tuesday on the Horn, and, of course, a reminder that Titanic Tuesday is so named for a little something that happened a good long while back now over on the right-wing radio station in Beckley, West Virginia, where a 962nd tier right-wing talker once answered the question from one of his mouth-breathing, knuckle-dragging followers, Steve, how come is it you reckon there is seashells, fossils in the rocks in West Virginia? To which he replied, well, that's easy, caller. That's because of the movement of the Titanic plates. So we celebrate Titanic right-wing intellect on Tuesdays here on the Horn. No word yet on the Titanic soft-boiled egg cups. We're still waiting. Let's see if the very, very tired old production computer will now let me into the chat room. We shall find out in fairly short order, if only I click the right button. All right, yeah. Thank you very kindly. Jeremy, loud and clear on TuneIn. Chat room is filling up, filling fast. Well, okay, yeah, but not that's not necessarily true. The chat room can never actually fill up. I think we've got tons and tons of room in the chat room, so don't be afraid that if you don't show up, you know, just right here, right now, that you're going to miss out. There's plenty of room. Plenty of room. Let's see. Be there in a second. Okay, well, we'll get there when we get there. These things happen. Let's see. Titanic Tuesday, and Kate wants it to be Ebola-free. Which is really not the... Oh, yeah, we do have a good crowd in there this evening. Good evening, Anatole. Good evening, Carol Baker. Good evening, Devin and Dwayne and Jeremy and Kathy and Michael and Art Kellison and Tim from L.A. and Todd. And of all, of course, capably moderated by longtime veteran, indefatigable Horn chat room moderator, Sparky. I guess scary Ebola is not in the room this evening. Ebola, Michael noting, Ebola is banned. I'm in a good mood. Ebola will ruin it. Oh, okay, yeah. So we'll stay away from that. But these aren't really Ebola stories now, are they? They're stories of the manifest geographical stupidity of ever so many American people. Maybe that's not news either, Kate. I get that. Of course, I had a note earlier today from our buddy Gary, labor man, who passed along the have a show on me concept introduced by Ed. Gary did so on Friday, challenging others to do the same. I had a note from Gary earlier today. How can I not share this, especially since it gives me the opportunity to, you know, do a voice? Kincaid, do you realize that the Ebolers is the most monstrously conceived and dangerous commie Kenyan Muslim plot we have ever had to face? I can no longer sit back and allow the commie Kenyan Muslim infiltration, indoctrination, subversion, and the international commie Kenyan Muslim conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids with them Ebolers. Kincaid, in the name of Jesus and the Continental Congress, come over here and help me with this belt, boy. You can't just walk past a really, really good Dr. Strangelove reference and let just leave it lay in there. No. But that's not to say there's not other Titanic stuff out there today. Oh, not by a long shot. Because there always is. You know, some some right-wing booger-eater, birther, deather, tenther, libertarian, bircher, repiglican, bagger. Yeah, there's never going to be a dearth of it. And so, no, these aren't Ebola stories. But it is worth noting, you know, we talked about Maine and Mississippi last night. We talked about the Pappy Slocum Elementary School in Pappy Yoakum Elementary School in New Jersey. Turns out there's a little more. This story also from Mississippi Stan, Poplarville, Mississippi Stan, to be particular. A school bus driver recently visited Ghana, which is 1,051 miles from the Ebola zone of Ebola Czar the Magnificent. Having gone to Ghana and come back uneventfully, he can't go back to work driving a school bus. No, really. According to WLOX, I don't think they really in Mississippi, do they know what LOX is? I don't know. Two Poplarville residents have returned to their homes in Poplarville, Mississippi, Stan, with the deadly Ebola virus, most prominent in West Africa. Word of the trip spread throughout Poplarville, raising concerns from some residents. There's the Fox style manual on display again. By the way, further proof that this is not an Ebola story, this is a culture story. WLOX spoke to one of those travelers over the phone. I love the addition of over the phone in this story. That's so that the WLOX viewers will not quit viewing WLOX for fear that the Ebola will be transmitted through the TV waves via the fillings in their teeth. She asked not to be identified to avoid harassment when she returns to Mississippi Stan. She told us they understand the concern, but are hoping they can come home peacefully. It was supposed to be the trip of a lifetime, a wedding officiated by her beloved pastor, some sightseeing, but most importantly, spreading the gospel to all who would listen. Oh, dear God. We're not having prayer meeting Wednesday tomorrow, so maybe this fits even better. What was supposed to be a wonderful experience turned sour when they began to receive phone calls that people back in their hometown of Poplarville, Mississippi, Stan, were worried about their return. Tuesday evening going into Wednesday, the school board was concerned. They had received a concerned parent complaint of the pastor driving the bus with their kids. On Thursday, the Poplarville School District said the bus driver and pastor would have to be cleared by the State Department of Health before he would be allowed to return to work. See, this ain't an Ebola story. This is a story about how goddamn dumb Americans can absolutely be. Now, so we've had Maine, Mississippi, Stan. Jeremy related a story last evening of a freak out in Vermont. We've had a freak out in West Virginia at the airport. Maine, Mississippi, Stan, Jersey, Vermont, West Virginia. Oh, Wisconsin. Pewaukee, Wisconsin, in particular. Parents kept their kids home from school there in Pewaukee because some international visitors from Uganda, which has its own problems, like hating on people for being gay. Thank you, evangelical fundamentalist Christian American. Yeah. So a couple of folks from Uganda were visiting the school, and consequently, parents in Pewaukee, who apparently... See, parents, apparently, what I did there, apparently have the IQ of, Pete Moss frozen in ice. They kept their kids home from school. because a priest and a teacher from Uganda were visiting said high school. Kim Peterman, a concerned parent, that's two separate articles from two separate media entities who described it. No. That's not a concerned parent. That's a dumber than a handful of hair parent. That's a dumber than a bag of hammer handles parent. Kim Peterman, I don't want to take it from the school and an experience it away from the kids, but as a parent, a letter? I'm not sure that in this situation if a letter is good enough. I don't think... Oh, Jesus. Then there's poor Dr. Joanne Sternke, who's superintendent of Pewaukee Public Schools up there in Wisconsin. Dr. Sternke said, I don't think people know that Uganda is approximately 3,000 miles away from where West Africa and other outbreaks are. 8 countries, 89 hours driving time, and a ferry ride away from Liberia. That didn't help Kim Peterman. As a parent, it's always going to be a worry. It's always going to be in the back of my mind. Was this a good idea? Oh, Jesus. This is really not about Ebola. This is really about too stupid with multiple O's. Carol Baker noting, Dear America, not all black people look alike. Not all African countries are affected by this epidemic. You're not going to get it. Stop acting like fuckards. Meanwhile, as she knows, America does seem to be suffering from dipshititis. And that's the crux of it all. I mean, it was cute, kind of, years ago. It was... And we all had a good chuckle. And because, well, how do you not? Let's go to the tape. After the ad, of course. Damn it. I mean, we have the story once a year. The National Geographic Society puts out its annual survey of just how geographically dumb this country is, and then you just turn on the TV.
The round of competition that ultimately determines their fate, the make-it-or-break-it moment. The ladies will have to demonstrate their ability to answer a thought-provoking final question. Sound simple? Easier said than done, especially when the whole country is watching. Here's how it works. Our panel of judges have prepared their own questions. So now, we will ask each finalist to pick the name of the judge, who will then ask a final question. Ladies, you'll have 30 seconds before you hear the sound of this bell. Good luck. We begin with South Carolina.
Oh, goody.
Hello, South Carolina, please pick out the name of a judge. Thank you. Judge number 5.
I still get nervous hearing the music.
Okay. Recent polls have shown a fifth of Americans can't locate the U.S. on a world map.
Let alone Africa.
Why do you think this is?
Ebola!
I personally believe that U.S. Americans are unable to do so because some people out there in our nation don't have maps. And
you know what? It used to be funny. Now, more and more, it appears to be a fact. And that now, with the whole internet thing out there, just that some U.S. Americans don't have maps or refuse to look at them or just think they already know.
And I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and I believe that they should, our education over here in the U.S. should help the U.S. or should help South Africa and should help the Iraq and the Asian country.
It's the most merciful bell ever played. But it's real. So you got a school in Wisconsin where people kept their kids home because of visitors from Uganda. I have a handy graphic here that shows that it is 3,266 miles to Uganda and Rwanda. Rwanda being where the kids are from who can't go to school in New Jersey. It's 2,891 miles from the Ebola zone to Zambia. It's 1,051 miles to Ghana, where they were witnessing in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. And folks don't know that. This matters. You know, Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, we carry Dr. Bill's program, which is focused primarily on the origins and continuing evolution of institutions of U.S. government in the United States. But you know what? The same people who run out and think that Cloven Bundy is a hero are the same people who think that Liberia is a county in a country called Africa. How can you begin to understand? I don't know. Can a person begin to understand things like why we are getting our war on again in Iraq and Syria, if you don't know where those places are? To what extent is this a product of electronic culture, mass communication, and rapid travel? If you're on an airplane and you look out the window, can you tell where you are? I play that little game sometimes when I'm on aircraft. Usually I do so by trying to imagine the route in my head, which is a failure to begin with because you never know where air traffic control is going to vector you. And then I start looking out the window trying to find me a river. If I can find a river, I can imagine generally right. You get the idea. But if the continent of Africa is just a place that's 10 hours away by plane, 12 maybe, depending on where you're going, even more if you're headed to, say, Johannesburg or Pretoria, right, Cape Town, then it's kind of like big numbers with lots of zeros. It loses meaning and relevance. But underneath all of that, is the inherent racism that goes with all of this. Africa is, after all, for a lot of people still,
the dark continent.
It's not a place with rich cultural diversity, nearly countless different cultures and cultural traditions. It's just the place where all the black people came from. And when you get right down to it, even and all of this is inexorably tied to the institution of slavery in the United States. And geographically, the people who were kidnapped, stolen, and sent down the Middle Passage to this continent to be enslaved were not broadly representative of people on the African continent in the first place either. Mostly, primarily, people from the western portion of the continent. most of us are painfully ignorant of what's going on the African continent. And I include myself in that. If you handed me a blank map of the African continent with just borders there for countries, you know, I might get 75% right. And I try to be relatively well informed. I will do dramatically better with Europe. I'll probably even do better with Asia. North and South America are going to be almost a lead pipe cinch. Why is that? And is it worth inquiring into why that is? But no, we certainly have lots of opportunity to examine Titanic intellect that does not touch upon Ebola, egads. By the way, working on our metaphors here, a note coming in from Luda. Bob, where IQ size is concerned, I prefer dumber with the IQ size of a wet bran muffin. And imagine a wet bran muffin is probably Atne Ute Aitbre, if you own what I mean. But speaking of Atne Ute Aitbre, let's check in on a completely different subject and topic. Let's check in with Skip Bayless over at ESPN's First Take program. Okay?
Story. Real quick, what I development meant about, of the story. What I meant about Edge is, remember Kobe pre-Eagle Colorado? He failed in his first sneaker deal because he was just too clean cut, and I think it was Adidas that had him first. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I don't remember.
But he couldn't sell sneakers because he didn't have enough edge. But then post-Eagle Colorado, he became, you know, it brought a little attention to him, like it gave him a little bit of sizzle.
All right. Oh.
Notice how little his Skip Bayless's two co-panelists have to offer in that exchange. Eagle Colorado is, in this context, shorthand for back when Kobe got accused of rape. Mm-hmm. A rape accusation, according to Skip Bayless, gave Kobe sizzle and made it possible for Kobe to be a more effective salesman of sneakers because it provided him edge. Hide your children, hide your wife. Not from Kobe, from Skip Bayless, who thinks that there's nothing to really jumpstart a promotional career like a rape allegation. No, not kidding. That's real. A real ESPN clip from really ESPN's First Take program. One step forward, 19 steps back. Yeah. So now, in light of the revelation that came out, a day or so ago, that that Ray Rice may be reinstated to football in a matter of weeks. Just got to wonder. Just got to wonder how much edge that's going to give him, having beaten the daylights out of a woman who later married him and became his wife. Edge. Will it provide him sizzle? Well, down in South Carolina, Stan, they're not worrying about sizzle. No, no. Down in South Carolina, Stan, Anthony Culler, C-U-L-L-E-R, Anthony Culler is much more worried, and he's even more worried about, he's more worried about this than he is about, you know, that disease that isn't an epidemic in the United States, but has incited an epidemic of epic stupidity. Anthony Culler is challenging Representative James Clyburn, Democrat from South Carolina. Oh, here we go. Duct tape, hockey puck, just saying.
Good evening, America. Lately, we've heard a lot about ISIS and Ebola and other threats to our country. And while those are very serious, I'd like to bring up something on a lighter note tonight. Something that is a threat, and that could be possibly the worst gremlin outbreak we've seen in 30 years. My name's Anthony Culler. I'm the Republican nominee for South Carolina's 6th U.S. Congressional District. I made a post recently where I brought gremlins into the mix. And I noticed something ironic about this.
Well, gremlins, sure, but not the AMC Pacer. I mean, that would be going too far. Yeah.
All across the nation, I have had all these bigots calling me a bigot, which I just find that ironic. I think it's really funny.
No, it's just because you're stupid.
Is I made a comment that same-sex couples that want to destroy traditional marriage and our way of life, they're gremlins. They're these creatures that are so destructive.
That was the goddess of irony sending the freight train through there, you know, just as he was reaching the gravamen of his argument. Might want to check the sacred timetables there, Anthony Culler, before you start your anti-gay folk ranting. That, I reckon that was a gay conductor? Yeah, I don't know. Let's do please. This is going to, why not?
You can hear the train in the background. I'm in King Street, South Carolina. And I want to tell you,
no.
My people here in this area.
Yeah, over-talk the train whistle.
Hope you can still hear me. Why people here in this area, in this district, feel the same way I do about the destruction of our traditional values. In the 6th district, if you're not from here, this is our majority-minority district. It's the black district.
And I'm not a black guy, but do continue.
That's what some people call it. I've been campaigning for the past...
Quick question. How is it that South Carolina, Stan, has managed to figure out a way to have a majority-minority district? How is it that in a state like South Carolina, Stan, it's possible to have a majority-white district? Because I'm pretty sure all the people of color in South Carolina, Stan, don't live there in one district. I mean, they're not all just, everybody's not just all camped out, you know, sitting there talking to each other on their free Obama phones at their FEMA re-education camp and having a high old time. No. A majority-minority district, which it isn't going to be for a whole lot longer. It's going to be a majority-majority district, and all those white districts around South Carolina are going to be majority-minority districts, if you know what I mean. I mean, but naturally, he's right upset at all them gay people out there assaulting his traditional family values. What did he describe earlier? Who want to destroy traditional marriage. You know what? we have no small number of gay people in the Horn Family Commune congregation. We are not tolerant. We are welcoming. And I have yet to hear even one declare even the tiniest desire to destroy much of anything, let alone traditional family values marriage. You know, those traditional family values marriages that at least 50% of the time wind up in divorce that was condemned by their Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Anyway, let's see if the train's gone.
Last tier here. 16 counties, 8,400 square miles, about the size of the state of Massachusetts. I've got another description for this district.
Wow, it took a single district the size of the state of Massachusetts to make sure that people of color couldn't affect the outcome of races in the other districts of South Carolina, Stan. Now, that, by God, is some geographical knowledge. And in point of fact, that district amounts to pretty much what would we call that? A franchise quarantine. Oh, y'all can vote all you want to, but just here.
It's a Christian district. I would go as far as to say that there are more churches in this district than probably per capita than probably any other district, U.S. congressional district in the United States. The people here, black, white, Democrat, Republican, we believe in family. We believe in traditional family. We believe in the way it's always been.
The only problem then becomes a matter of defining how it's always been, because 150 years ago, the way it's always been is not the way it is now. There, Anthony P. Keller. Oh, dear. And I'm guessing that the way it was always was there is not something that the way it was 100 is not something a lot of people now. I mean, maybe folks that are basically the same shade as Anthony Keller would like to go back to then, but not a lot of others. I mean, the governor of South Carolina would be out chopping cotton somewhere 150 years ago with those traditional family values that obtain in South Carolina, Stan. But do continue, Mr. Culler, who is not the least bit ironically named.
One man, one woman. Government can make up any laws it wants to. It doesn't make
it. No, it really can't. There's a constitution, Anthony Culler. I would hope you would know that running for Congress. But then again, you're a godforsaken teabagger, so you probably just think you're going to go to Washington and start yanking monkeys out of your butt. Right. Because the constitution exists only in the thin gray settling surrounding your great big giant lizard brain.
Right. Evil is evil. Wrong is wrong. Here in the 6th District,
I'd love to sit down and have a conversation with him about just exactly which evils are evil and which wrongs are wrong. For instance, was it wrong for, say, Abraham Lincoln to sign the Emancipation Proclamation in the middle of a civil war? For that matter, was it a civil war? Was the civil war about slavery? Because, see, that last one, that always gets them. They jump right up out of the duck blind hollering, economic issues! Economic issues! Yeah, yeah.
I'm running against Jim Clyburn. Jim Clyburn supports same-sex marriage. I don't. Jim Clyburn supports abortion. I don't. And the Christians in this district, they don't support it either, which I'm kind of confused because I've talked with a lot of you that I know have voted for Clyburn in years past. And you're solid pro-life people, you're good Christians, you're against same-sex marriage.
Not a single Jew, not a single Muslim, not a single Hindu, nobody. Nobody but just good Christians there in the 6th District of South Carolina, Stan.
And yet you side on that. Well, you've got another choice this year. November 4th, 2 weeks tomorrow, you can vote for Anthony Culler. I will bring you change, and you know, change only comes with change.
Okay, we're going to be working on that one for a while. Change only comes with change. Now, this is all over, because, see, South Carolina is a part of the 4th United States Circuit. It is overseen by the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. So when the Supreme Court of the United States recently said it was not going to hear the complaints of a bunch of weirdo bigots who wanted to keep a couple of people who actually love each other from forming a stable relationship via marriage that does not in any way impact his religion whatsoever, colors. South Carolina said, well, we still ain't going to be a marrying up them people. We're going to wait till somebody makes us do it. You know, kind of like it was when them people wanted to go to our stews, and we waited till the government put its jackbooted, thuggish jackboots on our neck and compelled us to destroy traditional South Carolina family ways by letting, you know, those ones go to our perfectly good schools. See how it works? Yeah. Change. Thank you, Devin. Change only comes with change. To wit, billionaire spare change, maybe from, say, the Koch brothers. Yeah. There's going to be marriage equality in South Carolina, whether they like it or not. Just like the schools were integrated in South Carolina, whether they liked it or not. Just like voting rights were enforced in South Carolina, whether they liked it or not. I guess you could say South Carolina is a barometer of resistance to that change that only comes with change. Yeah, Harley, come on down here with the white van. Don't turn the siren on or the flashing lights. Just bring the big butterfly net, Harley.
And another thing you can count on is no matter how many gremlins there are across this country.
Talk about dehumanization. He refuses to refer to gay people as human beings. They are to him gremlins. And this is what got it all started over on Facebook. If you believe in traditional families and that marriage is defined as an institution between one man and one woman, then I ask that you start acting like it and start voting like it. Don't buy the cuteness and the what will it hurt arguments whispered in your ears and marketed to our children. Whispered in your ears? Who's whispering in your ears there, Mr. Culler? Same-sex couples that seek to destroy our way of life and the institution of marriage are not cute and cuddly, but rather, for those of you that are old enough to remember the movie, gremlins that will only destroy our way of life. I suppose if you feed them after midnight, Jesus Christ. Yeah, maybe I've forgotten the movie. Okay, thank you, Dan. Well, stop spraying water on them after midnight then, damn it. So, we got that going for us, which is disturbing. But see, we got stuff besides, you know, the five-letter disease. Sure we do. Ever so much more stuff. Oh, what else? What else? There's a little bit of trouble brewing in Alabamistan. Mm-hmm. In the form of some political corruption. The guy who pretty much engineered the right-wing takeover of the legislature for the first time in 100 years is now the subject of a 23-count political corruption indictment But if he was found guilty on all counts, and if all counts were ordered to be served consecutively, might very well keep him in prison until the second coming of Jesus. And I'm not going to sit here and try to go through the details of it. Read about it if you wish, because this thing is circles within circles within circles within circles. And you know what? Here's the fun part. It all goes back to Karl Rove. Mm-hmm. And the sleazy business he engaged in Alabama back in the early parts, the earliest days of this century. And it's as ugly and nasty as anything you might possibly imagine. It is also entirely predictable. I mean, these guys, look, fiscal conservatism was never an idea. It was a, what, it was a cover. It was something to keep the rubes nice and ignorant. And it worked for a while. And you know what? Even if this guy does go to prison for the rest of his natural born days, Alabama's not going to get rid of its right-wing government. No, hell no. Because they got family values. Darn straight. Because if they started electing Democrats, well, I mean, you know, Jesus probably wouldn't like them. Oh, by the way, because we are equal opportunity here relative to criticisms of the religion industry. Let us take note of a program on the TV over in Saudi Arabia, Stan. I think the Stan is probably superfluous there, isn't it? Saudi Arabia. All right, yeah, all right. Those are the good headloppers. ISIL are the bad headloppers. Saudi Arabia are the good headloppers. They're the headloppers that are our friends. And over on Saudi Arabian TV, there really is a television show, apparently, and it's a big hit on Monday nights, because I guess it's on the only channel. No, it's not Monday Evening Rehabilitation, straight out of Idiocracy, but it's pretty damned close. It is Fatwa. That's the name of the television show, Fatwa. You know, those proclamations that wind up making authors go into hiding for the rest of their lives because some sort of headloppers without portfolio have been told that they'll get to have sex with the women they've never seen before in heaven if they'll just go kill somebody who has a fatwa introduced against them. No, the name of the television show is Fatwa, and it is hosted by Sheikh Abdul Aziz Al-Sheikh. And Sheikh Abdul Aziz Al-Sheikh, there's something about this that just makes me guess that he and Pat Robertson could host an ecumenical TV show that just would not quit. Because he sounds a lot like Pat. Well, I mean, in print, I have no idea what he sounds like. But he took to his program Fatwa on Monday to offer some friendly, religiously insane guidance to the people who tune into his program, which I suspect are very much like the Americans who tune into Pat Robertson. Sheikh Abdul Aziz Al-Sheikh is angry at, Come on. Women, no. Sheikh Abdulaziz al-Sheikh is angry at ISIL. No. Sheikh Abdulaziz al-Sheikh is angry at gay people. No. Sheikh Abdulaziz al-Sheikh is angry at the Twitter. Mm-hmm. Twitter. He issued a fatwa, I suppose, against Twitter last night. If it were used correctly, it could be of real benefit, he said of Twitter. But unfortunately, it's exploited for trivial matters. People are rushing to it thinking it's a source of credible information, but it's a source of lies and falsehood. It is the source of all evil and devastation. Oh, really? Twitter. I'm wondering if this has gotten any legs at all on Twitter yet, and whether perhaps a hashtag, hashtag devastation, or hashtag all evil has started going around with it, probably accompanied by photographs of kittens or a squirrel eating an ice cream cone. All evil. Jesus, it sounds like the guy's been reading the narration script for the beginning of the animated first heavy metal. I am the source of all evil. Tarna! Ah! Right? Oh, God. You see, this guy's intimidated by Twitter. Because people can look to Twitter and not look to him. Hey, dumbass, get on Twitter. Jesus, Monica Lewinsky got on Twitter yesterday. Whoop! She's already, and I was told repeatedly by the for-profit media, she already has more than 50,000 followers. Oh, come on, really? How's that work? I mean, I know social media is a miracle and everything, but how's that work? Just, you log in and you go, at Monica Lewinsky, and boom, 50,000 followers? Well, I ain't one. You know, unless Farmville or something's followed her for me. No, I don't play Farmville, I'm kidding. I don't play Mafia Wars either. Stop it. Oh, God. The source of all evil and devastation. Twitter. Not hunger. The Old Testament says that the love of money is the root of all evil. Nope, apparently not for, oh, hell, I've forgotten his name already. Sheikh Abdulaziz al-Sheikh. Nope, the love of money is not the root of all evil. Not by a long shot. Poverty? Also not the root of all evil and devastation. How about the great Satan United States? Nope, not the root of all evil and devastation. Twitter.
Be patient with him, God.
Oh, yeah. It really doesn't matter the faith structure. And it doesn't much matter the culture. Some things are just recognizably human wherever, whenever, however you find them. And one of those is the absolute maddening lust for power and authority over others. I wish I had it handy. I would play Cartman screaming, "Respect my authority!" right about now. I I remember being in Cleveland, a Cleveland clinic, with my father, getting some much needed work done on his circulatory system. Bought him a rock solid 10 extra years, Cleveland Clinic did. And imagine my surprise, little hillbilly that I am, to turn on the TV set there. We were waiting for his appointment the next day, and we were going to find a baseball game or a football game or whatever it was at that time of year. And zounds, like the first 15 channels were guys from Arabic-speaking regions, apparently doing the Arabic, maybe Qatari, UAE, Saudi Arabian, Kuwaiti version, Jordanian version of the PTL club. Jeebus. Yeah, it's going to be. It's got potential to be a busy little Titanic Tuesday evening. That we're kind of merging with prayer meeting Wednesday. Remembering, of course, that there will be no program tomorrow evening or Thursday. Got a couple of things going on. Got to go and get the boy at the airport, and then got to take Agnes to the doctor. Note coming in from Kate. Subject line, Obama. It's very close to Obama. You get it? See what she did there? Yeah, it's radio. You can't see. Kate noting, oh, please tell me that Riley's going under the jail. No, but I don't know about that part yet, but it turns out the Hubbard guy who has the 23-count indictment against him, Kate, one of the people that he shook down in his little political corruption scheme was Bob Riley and his daughter, shaking him down for business. It's sort of a watch this space kind of situation, because when the leader of the Alabama Republican Party, and he is de facto leader of the Alabama Republican Party, gets taken down with a 23-count indictment, you get the idea, you know, whoever it is probably going to sit down with him and say, you know, we got enough here to put you away for a long time, unless you want to start telling us a little more about how this all went down. I mean, you don't want to take this one by yourself, do you? You didn't swear Omerta or anything, did you? Yeah, start singing, pigeon. Yeah. K-Dads, more good news. Queers can finally get married in Wyoming unless something's changed since the early news today. I don't think it has. They should be able to get married in South Carolina, but the South Carolina federal judge is, they're going to have to make me. Maybe send in some federal troops just to get a marriage ceremony performed by a justice of the peace or some such. Yeah. So it's about 2 minutes before the hour. I want to extend thanks to Joseph. Thank you very kindly for jumping into helping us keep all of this on the air, jumping in with Joan this evening for this evening's fundraising. We now need only $40 to finish fundraising for the evening. That would be mighty, mighty helpful. 8 at 5, 10 at 4, 2 at 20, 1 at 40, 1 at 30, and 1 at 10, 35 and 5, 25 and 15. Any combination works just fine, and the PayPal PayPal widget is right there on the contribute page at headonradionetwork.com. We have the Green News Report upcoming with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen, and then, hopefully, Conversation Radio, your calls. You know the number, right? 304-663. Uh-huh. 4676. That's 304-663-HORN. H-O-R-N. 304-663-4676. Or 304-574-8178. Or on Skype to Skype, simply Bob Kincaid Horn. B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. Bob Kincaid porn. All told, pretty doggone easy. You can also always reach me on you know, the root of all evil and devastation, Twitter, at Bob Kincaid. You can catch me on Facebook. And I also encourage you to join up with our little group at the Head On Radio Network, The Horn, on Facebook. Just search it, and somebody will admit you to membership and send you your secret decoder ring, your hockey puck, your duct tape, and your toaster. Okay? Yeah. So light them up. Give us a holler. Let me know what's on your mind this year. Not me. Let us all know what's on your mind here this Titanic Tuesday. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Don't let these shakes go on. It's- It's Tuesday, October 21, 2014.
Can you answer that question that you didn't answer on stage? Do you think man contributes to climate change or not?
Republican candidates still dodging the climate change question.
There is a personal cost paid by those families who live near coal mining sites.
Mountaintop removal coal mining promotes lung cancer. Another day, another oil spill, this time in Louisiana. 2014 is on track to be the hottest year on record. Plus,
everything is awesome.
Lego breaks up with Shell Oil.
All of those breakups and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Do you believe climate change in part is caused by activities of man?
Yes.
Wow. Finally, a direct answer from a Tea Party candidate for governor of Connecticut.
But not the activities necessarily that some scientists believe they are.
No, brother. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, all campaign season long, we have been tracking these Republican candidates as they have been asked about climate change really for the first time in any election cycle. And the dodges and dancing has really been extraordinary to watch.
I know. It's kind of funny. Republican candidates have been trying to evade the question of whether they accept the scientific consensus on man-made global warming. Most recently, in the Connecticut governor's race, here's the Republican nominee, front runner Tom Foley.
Mr. Foley, what do you think the cause of climate change is?
Well, what I've said is it doesn't really matter. It's happening. So if a leader and people in positions of public responsibility need to address a threat. So I don't think there's any debate about whether or not it's happening, so we have to find solutions.
So it's happening, perhaps by magic, but we need to do something about it. Okay, that's progress.
Connecticut's governor, Democrat Daniel Malloy, was unequivocal.
Of course it matters. And yes, we've had Irene and Sandy and storms and months that we've never had snow in before and amounts of snow that we've never seen before. Of course climate change is real. Of course it's beaten us up. Of course it's cost us money. And to deny that is to deny reality.
He says deny reality like that's a bad thing or something.
Well, not to Joe Visconti, the Tea Party Republican running as an independent in the Connecticut governor's race. He's got news for scientists.
I believe we are in climate change, but it may not be global warming. There's a book called Chill. You all should look at it. Chill is the name of the book, and it talks about the fluctuations of the climate and actually moving more into a mini ice age.
Unbelievable, the dancing and dodging. How about just going with science?
Meanwhile, the real scientists at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration are also unequivocal. The planet is now on pace for 2014 to be the hottest year on record. The last 12-month period was the hottest 12-month stretch on record. And NOAA also says ocean warming is accelerating. Although some of these non-scientists claim we've had no global warming in 18 years, a NOAA scientist tells AP, quote, "No one bothered to tell the globe that." Now, the question is, if 2014 does end up being the hottest year on record, will the deniers stop saying we're in global cooling?
Of course not. Why would they? They've got fossil fuel industry money they need to make. These elections aren't just going to run themselves, Des.
Cleanup has begun after an oil pipeline rupture in a northern Louisiana bayou over the weekend dumped an estimated 170,000 gallons of crude oil into a residential area. Residents were evacuated, but 140 wild animals didn't get that warning and have been confirmed dead. Mountaintop removal coal mining, again, linked to lung cancer.
Federal government has to conduct a study on the health impact of mountaintop removal before it issues any more permits.
That was Representative John Yarmuth, Democrat of West Virginia, in a congressional hearing last July calling for a moratorium on federal permits for mountaintop removal coal mining. And not a moment too soon, a new West Virginia University study has found that the dust from mountaintop removal coal mining actually promotes the growth of lung cancer tumors. The study confirms previous research showing families living near coal operations have increased risk of cancer, birth defects, and early death. Dr. Matthew Wasson of Appalachian Voices tells Congress it's ample evidence for a federal moratorium on mountaintop removal.
There's too much information showing health problems to continue to ignore.
You know, when you've got a congressman from West Virginia, of all places, Democrat or not, calling for a moratorium on mountaintop removal coal mining, it seems like people ought to be standing up and paying attention.
Finally, some good news. In a blow to Shell Oil's PR strategy to get its logo on children's toys, Lego has now announced it will not renew its contract with Shell Oil after a creepy viral video by Greenpeace depicting Lego toys drowning in oil.
Everything is awesome.
So no more of those little Shell Oil logos on my Lego set?
That's right.
That's just so sad. For much more on that story and all of the other ones we covered and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website where everything is awesome at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us and follow us on the Facebook and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Everything is awesome.
No, not dead air. Oh, dear. Sorry, it kind of caught me out there. It's 12 minutes past the hour, and I'm just wrapping up a quick little email to Brad and Desi. There, all better now. No, the reason I was sending off an email to Brad and Desi is because no. John Yarmuth is not from West Virginia. Come on, Brad, Desi, I love you. Call me, I'll help you. If, in fact, John Yarmuth was from West Virginia, the Earth would have already moved into retrograde motion. There would be pigs in the treetops, sheep would be flying, and infinite monkeys would be typing Hamlet on infinite typewriters. Because the world would have gone completely freaking sideways. No. West Virginia doesn't have any politicians that would try to protect people against mountaintop removal. John Yarmuth is, in fact, from Louisville, Kentucky, which is why he can safely introduce a bill which, you know, hey, but you guys probably already recognize that, right? That quote from John Yarmuth, he was talking about the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, the AIC Act, which, in fact, you know, you've been a big part of. Just making that, just kind of clearing things up for a minute there. Let's go to the phones on this Titanic Tuesday. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello? Stand by. Here I am.
Oh, there you are. Bob, this is Diane in Kansas Den.
Welcome to the Gizmo Line, Diane.
Gizmo Line. Thank you. And how are you, Bob?
I'm well. I just had a little bit of a sneezing frenzy, which made things a little bit weird there, but I'll get better.
I missed it.
That was by design. I try not to do that to people.
Oh, you put the cough button on or, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But, hey, you're learning the business, Diane.
I'm learning the business, yeah, from you.
Meanwhile, out in Kansas, they're giving you the business.
No, they're okay out here, I guess. Here's my offering about Kansas. Not that I called in about this, but they behave differently in everyday life. That's my experience in Kansans. They behave differently in everyday life than you would expect them to, given what you hear on the news. And I wonder how much that is true across the board.
I think that is largely true, Diane, and it's good that you would bring that up because there's a profound disconnect at work in this country. Just to go back for a minute, the woman who was uncomfortable in Pewaukee, Wisconsin, having her child go to school on a day when there was a priest and a teacher from Uganda, that woman is probably completely normal the rest of the time.
I was walking around campus and I was on TuneIn, and I heard you talk about that. And, God only knows how much everyone's, on the edge because of the barrage of news, and you've made that point.
But that's the thing. I'm not on the edge, Diane. I'm nowhere near the edge. I'm not in the same zip code with the edge, and I don't think I don't think most of the Horn Family Commune congregation are either.
I don't know anyone at the university who is, I don't know anyone in this small town this town of 60,000 in Manhattan who is. I mean, I don't know who is except what's reported on the news, and then you get the idea that everyone is.
No, just enough to make a problem. And that's a little gentle reminder for all of us, Diane. Remember, it doesn't take a majority of people to create a problem. It just takes a noisy plurality.
Apparently. Well, to continue with the theme of people acting normal, I find the people in Kansas very, very helpful in a very practical way. For instance, when I moved out here from Pittsburgh, and I love Pittsburgh, I was thinking, oh, I should tip this person for doing this or that. I don't remember what. I mean, it seemed like I was always tipping people in Pittsburgh. and here they go, oh, no tip. We had work to do and we did it. And I was like, oh, where am I?
Kansas.
Kansas. But here's the thing. I have called the Riley County Elections Office before just to make sure I'm following the rules because I'm registered non-affiliated and the Republicans only let you do certain things that the Democrats here don't care. And that's part of the problem. They don't care. I mean, that's really part of the problem, but as far as I can tell. So I have talked with people at this office in Riley County, and which is Manhattan's in Riley County, and they are always so helpful. They go out of their way to be helpful. If I have a question, to mail a ballot in, to confirm that they received the ballot, they couldn't be more helpful. Okay. So enter into my brain this whole thing about Republicans not wanting people to vote, that we've been living through. And all of a sudden I'm calling these nice people that I talked with on the phone for a couple of years in Raleigh County and saying to them, I know you're really nice and you're helping me, but I no longer trust the process. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like... No, and I mean, that's on me, but it's not really about me. To me, it means these normal, functional, constructive relationships. That's an example of how what's reported on in the broader stratosphere enters into or can enter into what is otherwise a functioning, caring community. And, odd that it happened, but I'm not the only one because the last time I was at the poll, there was a young student. They had moved the polling place on us, and as they explained to us, the student stood in front of the election, the polling officials and said, well, they're trying to get us not to vote by moving the polling places around. And he's saying this to a really nice retired person who's trying to help at the poll. And so, they kind of, I don't know who they is, but it enters into daily life where there was nothing wrong with relationships previously.
Right.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does, and it serves as a divisor.
Well, and I kind of let it, but I'm not thinking it's about me. I'm not thinking it's about the student. I'm thinking that given the information we know and what's objectively happening, going through the courts about changing the rules for voting and that ridiculous Secretary of State of ours proposing publicly to have a two-tiered system. I mean, we're not talking about paranoia here on my part.
No. Paranoia is the irrational fear that people are out to get your vote.
Yeah, these people are out to get us. And what I'm aware of, when I stop thinking of it broadly in an abstract terms, what I'm aware of is in daily relationships, it enters in to affect them adversely. And I don't want to make a big deal of this, because the people at the polling place were very nice to the students, and the people on the phone to me from Raleigh County were very patient with my comments, and were just, they're just, they got their focus on their task. You know, their task focus. They're not acting like the clerks, you know.
Right, and there are ever so many people, Diane, who are just desperate to live their daggum lives.
I know, and people have been doing that here pretty well, I think. You know, I get the biggest kick out of my students. I never teach leading with politics, and oh, my God in heaven, oh, no, no, no. When I teach about corporate social responsibility, we talk about who are the stakeholders to the firm and what rights do consumers have that are legal versus moral and blah, blah, blah. And we just put it all in a community context, and these people from communities in western Kansas get it before I've even finished the sentence. They get it. They get community. They get responsibilities to their neighbors. They have to, what I'm always, and so it works for them to be in that thought experiment, you know. They've looked at it. But they've been, with that grounding, with that knowledge, that innate knowledge or socialized knowledge, whatever they have, I bet you, dimes to donuts, that they vote Republican because somehow it's all changed to anti-other at the poll. You know, that breaks my heart. I mean, I don't sit around crying about it, but it's just disturbing.
Well, it absolutely is. And the degree to which the electorate, and I despair sometimes. I mean, I had that long rant last Friday on the front porch about how sick I am of these godforsaken mailers and the phone calls and the ads on TV, and that somehow this is the price we pay for freedom of speech. No, it isn't. But the fact of the matter is, is there a single, and you know, you're data driven. Is there a single shred of data out there that suggests that all these filthy ads don't work? Because the only reason they do them, Diane, is because they do. Dividing us against ourselves works.
Yeah, I'm not into the data in that realm, but I think just from watching for politics for several years pretty closely, I think it obviously works. I mean, you've said that there's, for every one progressive news outlet, there are, what is that?
A thousand hours. That's what I was told years ago.
Well, I don't see how it wouldn't work under those conditions, because I was listening to an interview that George Lakoff gave today, and it's pretty obvious to me from...
God, he's so smart.
He's very smart, and the Democrats should listen to him. I mean, he actually went through what Democrats have done to just, like, give away the framing, you know? But he's probably been into neuroscience and stuff, because he's saying that 98% of what we think, of what we conclude, comes from an unconscious place because of the taken for
granted
metaphor.
Right, he's deeply into cognitive analysis.
Yeah.
Not what do we think, but how do we think?
And that we just take it for granted. We don't really even know our frames unless we kind of pull them out so that we can examine them. But, you know, he was saying that Elizabeth Warren was giving the proper frame when she was looking at business and how business has to have the public, has to have roads and courts, and has to have education. You know, I mean, all the stuff that you and I and all the foreign listeners know. And he said, so she got it right. And then he said, within a day or two, President Obama comes out And he's speaking off the cuff, so I guess we could give him that. And he said, they didn't build it, or you didn't build it. And Lakoff was saying, wrong thing to do. And then he said, when the media specialists that are around President Obama had a chance to correct it, they didn't really do it. Mm-hmm. They didn't reframe it and use the proper metaphor. And
no, but a lot of people out here in the hinterlands were properly framing it. And And ultimately, in a way, that presidential contest, Diane, came down to a question between the people who were disgusted with Bishop Romney for suggesting that 47% of America are mooching slackers, and the people, you know, and it turned out there were more people who were pissed about that than there were people who were pissed at Barack Obama for suggesting that we all benefit from the commons. You know,
mm-hmm.
roads are the commons. Clean water systems are the commons. Our tax structure is the commons.
Well, Lakoff was saying that President Obama didn't do what you just did. That by just saying they didn't build it or you didn't build it, he didn't frame it the way, you know, and tap into the proper metaphors for it. But then I guess what you're saying is what Romney did with that 47% taker thing, that comment he did when he thought no one was taking him. I mean, you're saying that was more insulting, I would think. That was more insulting to more people. So, you know, thank God that happened.
Well, I mean, consider what you started the conversation talking about, you know, those folks in Kansas. Who are, you know, we had a job to do and we did it. You know, we're just out here working. This is our lives. And you've got a billionaire looking at you saying, I don't care how much you're working, you're a mooch.
Well, it's a,
you know, because you want social security when you're old, because you want to be able to not go into poverty just to go to the doctor when you're old, you moocher.
But somehow those connections don't get made by those people. I mean, those people I'm talking about, and I'm not here to defend Kansas because I really don't understand it, and I moved away from it for a reason when I was younger. I just watched. When there was a reason, I did. But these people, the people I run into in Kansas, and my mentor flew in from Pennsylvania, from University of Pittsburgh, once to give a talk in Kansas City, and he had been dean of the business school at UMKC at one time, and he said in his address to these people in Kansas City, he said, I forgot how very helpful the people are in this city. He said, I got off the plane, and the friendliness and helpfulness is palpable. I mean, it is.
Oh, it absolutely is, and it's the same way, and in many ways I've tried to make that clear about the places I know about, the South and Appalachia. You know, if you're broke down on the side of the road, somebody will stop and help you. And if you need help loosening up a lug nut on a flat tire or whatever, they'll do it. And, you know, maybe they'll sit there and say, I can't, you know, they'll sit there loosening that lug nut. I can't believe that Kenyan Muslim socialist is destroying our country. Ah, there, we got it loose. Praise Jesus.
Reminds me of how Mr. Stress said he used to talk when he was repairing cars.
Yeah.
But here's the thing to me, and I've watched this in the work context too. What annoys me, and I don't know any other way to put this, when the elites, and especially, I don't know what class I'm in. I'm sort of in a, I don't know, but it's not really about me, but I realize I have a charmed life, but I'm not going to include myself with the elites, this other group of elites. I think there's a, in sociology, there's kind of a, if you do social strata in a functionary way, there's always professors and lawyers, and they kind of keep the system going.
Well, was it George W. Bush who said, if you're making less than $1 million a year, you're not rich?
Yeah, well, I'm not rich then. Okay, but I think I'm so well off that I like to, I mean, compared to a lot of other people who do not have job security for one thing, which I fortunately have. I just like to remind myself about that in any, you know, at any given time. But what annoys me about what I see here in the workplace and in Kansas is when the elites, I don't even know how to describe it, but I see it, when they manipulate these people with hearts of gold and exploit them and turn their minds into, you know, that would are helpful to others, but somehow all that gets turned into let's not have people get assistance or whatever.
Right, and what you're doing right there, Diane, is you're identifying the very heart and soul of it. Because what these elites, and I think that's the appropriate word for it, are doing is they're manipulating fears. And anyone who plays on fear, anyone who manipulates fear, should have a special level of hell just for them
in that
Dantean universe. Because what they're doing is saying, you work hard. I mean,
the 11th level.
Right. Yeah, you can script this stuff. You work hard. You've provided for your family because this is America. Now, that man wants to give away telephones to those people. Why does he hate you? And boom!
Yeah, but I'm talking about something that kicks in, I think, even before that, Bob. I mean, I'm sure you're right because I'm seeing ads for Orman. You know, the non-affiliate here who hopefully will be Pat Roberts, so
right.
It could help the U.S. Senate just stay out of Republican hands by one U.S. Senator. And by the way, I think Orman looks like Mark Ruffalo a little bit, but I always think that one. Moment of Shallow in trivia. But when I see Roberts' ads against him, against Orman, he puts Orman's face against Obama. And Obama is not popular here, except in Lawrence, Kansas. That's an oasis of, you know, progressivism, and it was founded by people interested in human rights and all that. But something else kicks in. It's not just what you said, Bob. I mean, at some point, the manipulation of, I don't know what, I mean, I don't know if those people throwing themselves in front of cars in Wichita in front of women's reproductive health clinics, I don't know if they were motivated by fear, but before all that, like, here's what I see, that these people, I'm going to generalize like that, and my mentor said the same thing because he had been, at UMKC and had, well, that's Kansas City's a different place, but it's like they're kind of naive about power relations. I'm just going to say that. They're just naive about power relations. And, you know, they don't have a history of striking like in...
You know, it's so interesting. I was sitting here as you were speaking, Diane, and I was thinking, you know where we're going? No, like the anti-abortion people are not the same as the people who hate people or who are on welfare. They might overlap in a Venn diagram, but they're not necessarily the same groups. But if you sit down and you do power mapping on them, you will find tentacles working back to a common source.
Yeah, you think.
And then lo and behold, you bring up understanding the nature of power. Yeah.
Well, I think they're easily. Because the reason I think that is it didn't come from growing up in a suburb in the greater Kansas City area, which is where I grew up, because that was a bubble. That was a wealthy, white, right bubble, which I had to leave as soon as I could.
I know of some of those suburbs, and you,
yes. Leawood, Mission Hills. Thomas Frank grew up in Mission Hills. Really, I know where he grew up. Foo-foo, he had to break with that. And look at his analysis. You kind of step back and look at it. And a lot of my family was in Mission Hills, and I grew up in Leawood. It's just a bubble. I think it still is.
And I spent a little time in Parkville.
Yeah.
Privileged
bubble. But anyway, I didn't see this. I mean, I didn't see this as much in Kansas City because when I grew up there, there was still, car manufacturing and I can't remember what
area. It was still the place that gave us Harry Truman.
Yeah, and it was Harry Truman, yeah, for his good and bad, but yeah, Harry Truman, and then, you know, some unions had a place there. In fact, one of my first teaching assignments after I got my master's in economics at UMKC was to teach for the AFL-CIO with a junior college there. They had a program for working people where they could watch a TV show, TV lectures over the weekend, and then come on the weekend and some of us would teach them. My God, these were people on the production line. Do you know what I was teaching them? Friedrich Nietzsche? John Steinbeck? I swear to God. I mean, this curriculum was already established. And they came to me and they said, we know you teach economics, but, this is the curriculum. And I'm like, well, all right. You know, and that was, it's beautiful, you know. When you think about that, people who work for a living, I think that's more European model. I just don't think in the U.S. we understand how powerful that is.
But it absolutely is, and that's something I was thinking a few minutes ago. The changing dynamic of the American tattered remnants of the middle class, the assault on the middle class, the assault on organized labor that began with the arrival of Ronald Reagan in the White House, the transformation, as was just noted by Carol in the chat room. It went from Bendix and Ford and General Motors in KC to McDonald's and Subway. When you've got people who are sweating everything, they're juggling the mortgage versus the car payment versus the insurance versus the health care versus the groceries versus gasoline, and nothing balances, that puts people in a precarious position, at which point they can be easily manipulated, because all you have to do is give them an easy explanation for why it is that way. And usually the person explaining why it is that way is the person who's part of the problem, and he's saying, look at the birdie over there. And the birdie just happens to be the other, the them, the they. And as a consequence, it focuses the beam, if you will.
Well, yeah, I think.
I mean, that's the so-called Southern Reagan Democrats in a nutshell.
Yeah. Well, I think it works better when, from my frame of reference, that didn't work perfectly well in Pittsburgh. You know what I'm saying? Because there was a history of where there's no history of struggle with power relations. I think it goes down pretty quickly. You know, I think it's like pudding, you know, people just slurp it off. But where there's I didn't see that go down so easily among people in Pittsburgh.
Well, I just remember what was happening as I was, and this is unique to me, okay? So it's not data as such, but it's empirically gathered evidence of one form or another.
Yep.
When I was a sophomore in high school, the world was my oyster. And we had a talk in the living room. You know, you work hard and we've worked hard and we're going to be able to send you anywhere you want to go to college. Okay. Between the end of my sophomore year in high school and the beginning of my senior year of high school, the ship came into the harbor and sank and blocked all other shipping. Because that's when the economy of my little corner of Northwest Alabama went into free fall. My dad got sick. His longtime employer, Reynolds Metals Company, his supervisor said, listen, you're sick. Why don't you just quit and get a job at a gas station?
Oh, jeez.
They denied, he had to fight for his pension. He had to fight for his Social Security disability. And because, you know, in the final analysis, he had been poisoned by where he worked
Oh, dear.
And all the crap that he breathed.
Well,
But at the same time that was happening there, you know, Reynolds was falling apart, Ford Motor Company was falling apart, Union Carbide was falling apart, Diamond Shamrock was falling apart. All of those companies that had located along the banks of the Tennessee River there were just going to hell. And the whole damned economy was collapsing, so that by the time I came home from my freshman year in college, the overall unemployment rate was second in the United States only to Detroit, Michigan. With the with the added irony that the main drag running through Muscle Shoals, Alabama, was the had the same name as the main drag running through Detroit, Woodward Avenue.
Oh my!
Because Henry Ford had tried at one point in time to buy Wilson Dam to generate, and he was everything that he did in the Detroit area, he was going to do in Northwest Alabama.
But all of that stuff developed. Monsters get big and mean and.
And then lo and behold, all of those people who had been voting Democrat for generations suddenly woke up and one morning and decided that they were Reagan Democrats, and the so-called Reagan Revolution, which was more like the Reagan insurgency or the Reagan assault on the American middle class, was off and running. And the people who were loading the muskets were the people who were getting the muskets turned on them.
Yeah, that's divided by social issues, right? Don't you think?
In
the workplace.
Yeah,
because
1980 also marks the rise of Jerry Falwell and his so-called moral majority.
That's a nasty story. It's gruesome. I mean, it doesn't say much for the country that it could turn that way. And
on a dime, Diane,
yeah,
on a dime.
It doesn't say much about us at all. I really wish my grandparents came over here from Stockholm, and I grew up here in Swedish. And, you know, I've been to Stockholm, and I've looked up a couple relatives. I'm pretty darn sure I'd have been better if they just stayed there. Maybe I guess I wouldn't be here, but yeah, well, whatever. I just really love wandering around Stockholm, you know. And I have a research partner who's a Dane at Odense University, and, you know, we compare notes, and, you know, it just doesn't have to be this way. Necessarily, but it is this way.
I think the beginning of hope, if we dare indulge in any of it, Diane, is that it doesn't have to be this way. But once we walk past, take the first step off that starting line, then we have to work toward how do we make it not be this way.
Well, that's where I go to. That, I mean, I look at a couple things. I look at the millennials being different, having different preferences, and there's some hope in that. But right now, I think the levers of change are, I mean, I'm not saying it couldn't change, but I see heavy hands on the levers of change that used to work.
Oh, I see them as well, and I agree wholeheartedly. Here's where I come from, and I think we've discussed this before. The right-wing white power structure in this country is the portion of the polity that is most interested in the social cultural stuff. The corporate elite doesn't give a damn about the cultural or social issues, as
not
long
as Hobby Lobby.
Well, yeah, and but I think that, you know, honest to God, I think Hobby Lobby's an outlier.
Yeah.
I think it opens a door. I don't know how many are going to go through it, but
I mean, they better go through it with fear and trepidation of what a lot of their consumers might
do
on social media.
But you know, your giant corporations don't give a damn as long as they're making obscene profits. Okay. And as long as they're not paying out good wages, and in other words, as long as they keep the workforce, you know, rocked on its heels, off balance, whatever you want to say, however you want to describe it, and desperate enough that they won't cause any trouble. I mean, We had an attorney general candidate in some state the other day who told people who work at fast food restaurants to go get a real job, you know, because there's so many of them. But
well,
but okay, so there's
stalking.
So there's that. But what I'm getting at here is that you know that noisy plurality, which is all you really need. They're the ones who are ham-fisting the levers of power, and for one reason and one reason only.
They got the megaphone?
No, it's not just that. They are determined because of their mindset. You know, there are social structures like Social Security and Medicare and a variety of other things with which they weren't crazy about it, but they were okay with it as long as the white people were getting it. Okay?
Yeah.
But we are moving toward a country that is going to be a so-called minority-majority country, and it's going to be here in 20 to 40 years, all right? And that element, so we factored out the big corporations, that element is hell and be damned going to see it all gone, taken apart, burnt down, before they're going to let those people get hold of it, okay?
Ugly.
It is ugly as hell, and I wish, and you know, I don't say this for shock value or inflammatory purposes. I say this as a reflection of the reality that I observe. Now, what happens with all of that? The reason for all of the voter ID laws and all of the voter suppression that's going on is because of one thing and one thing only. There is a census coming up in the year 2020,
which is just
5.5 short years from now. I have said repeatedly that I expect to see a Republican majority in the House of Representatives until the November elections of 2022. I expect to see a Republican majority in the Senate off and on between now and then. I don't know about the presidency. But the fact of the matter is, that's the first chance. I mean, if the hands are going to be wrested away and other hands are going to pull those levers of power, the first opportunity for that to really happen to any appreciable degree, in my estimation, Diane, is November 2022.
Yeah.
And that's pretty grim to look at, because that makes me a 59-year-old guy at that point.
Well, it means we have to all keep living in some kind of no man's land, you know, holding on to a vision, bracing ourselves. I mean, I fully expect them to phase out Social Security so that, like, I get it, but my son doesn't, as if I'm happy about that.
And once again, that's a further act of division. You know, all this, and I remember a couple of years ago talking about this at some length. There was a real attempt out there to drive another one of those divisors, another wedge between, and this one was not racial, this was generational, because I remember the ads, you know, back when Dem Leader said he was going to spend some political capital in 2005 and piratize Social Security, and everything that all the messaging was to older Americans, nothing will change about your Social Security. Well, you know what? The fact of the matter is, For my age group, Social Security has already changed. 65 is a damn pipe dream, okay?
Yeah.
And so
What did retirement age for Social Security used to be? I mean, it's 62 now if it's early. 66,
It was 62 and 65.
Okay, and now it's 62 for one thing, early, and 66 for another level, and 72 for getting more. Oh, no. I don't know. I haven't looked at it for a while.
Well, I don't either, but I know I'm pretty sure I don't get to knock off at 65 and start taking the long walk to the mailbox.
I may, but
I just noticed Kelly in the chat room said 67 for me. I think I'm part of that 67 class too. And you know what?
Okay.
Here's the fun part, Diane. When they ran that 67 thing through, you know what my generation was doing?
No.
Because it was some years back. We were probably coughing our eyeballs out, you know, having taken too big a hit off the bong.
Oh yeah. Oh well, that yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think on some level they're punishing us for that. I mean, on some level, they didn't like it that we were in the street. They didn't like it that we bucked authority. I mean, really.
No, and I mean, and that's the same. That's what I was saying about the corporate overlords wanting to make sure everybody stays rocked on their heels. You know what? The kind of transformational social change that's brought about by massive civil disobedience is only, you know, that's never, with all due respect to the people who marched at the People's Climate March, and with all due respect to the people who go to these things in D.C., because I've participated in a bunch of them, okay? And I've said it before, and it's like a repeat, but as long as the power structure understands, Diane, that you're going to show up on Friday night and you're going to have your big thing on Saturday, and then on Sunday you're going to be gone, nobody has to pay attention to that.
Right. Well, especially with free speech zones.
And you don't. And
the minute I saw free speech zones pop up, I'm like, oh, gee.
Yeah, but the larger point, I think, is that that's the only way. You know, first of all,
I get your point. It's not like Ferguson. It's not like Ferguson where there's a spark, a real spark.
Well, no, and not even just that, but one protest, such as you see on the Mall in D.C., has been reduced to a form of stylized, ritualized theater. But secondly, you can't do anything more than come in on Friday, protest on Saturday, and go home on Sunday, because on Monday you got to go back. And hell, maybe Sunday for that matter. Some people can't even come at all because of the way things are. But by God, for sure, for the people who can be there, come Monday, you got to be back on the job because you have the velvet shackles of the mortgage and the car payment. And all the things that attend on what people like to pretend is an ordinary middle class life. And you can't go and sit in the cold and the rain and the sun and the heat like people who are desperate to change their governments in places like the Czech Republic or Romania or any of those the Arab Spring or anything, because you're not desperate enough yet, and the cable's still on and there's a cable bill to be paid even though they've taken away SpongeBob.
Oh, God. No, your points are well taken and very true. And if there is moreover, if there is a spark, we've talked about this before, there are tanks now. There's a militarization.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you saw it or not, but some St. Louis Rams football fans got into it with some Ferguson protesters last Sunday.
Oh, no. Well, who came out walking? I mean, what happened? I don't know what happened.
There was scuffling. I don't have the story in front of me. I just saw it in passing.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. Well, I'm not for the sports team in that scenario. I don't know what the scuffle was about, but you know, things can happen when people get on the street and they get mad. I mean, stuff can happen that's unforeseen and who knows why in the moment. People are unhappy. But, Bob, I want to circle back to one thing, if I may, because I don't know how this I think this does fit in with what you've just – the picture you've just painted. But you know how Max Weber wrote about the Calvinism here and the work ethic and all that?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
He actually came to Missouri and looked around and went to Baptist revivals and it's kind of in that mode. What I see in the Midwest, at least where I'm at, is a real strong work ethic. So I see it in the workplace where these people have a real strong work ethic and they want to be loyal about it and they want to do what's in front of them, and that means doing what they're told. And what I have seen, evidence of, which I don't really like, is that work ethic is, it's not only manipulated with fear, that's not really what I'm saying, although I know that occurs, but within the frame of workplace that I'm putting this, I see that they're just, like, these are good-hearted people, and they are community-minded and they have a strong work ethic. So they're not schooled in power relations. I'm just going to put that out there because that's what I'm seeing.
Oh no, I think you're absolutely correct.
And you see how, I mean, there doesn't have to be fear manipulation. They're just going to be exploited.
Right, but remember, you know, and it's worth noting that all of this happens within the context at the same time where, have you noticed that there are no employees anymore? They're all team members or associates or and it goes hand in hand with the fact that nobody has a customer anymore. Everybody's a client. You know, it used to be
partner,
the only
partner, business partner.
Yeah, it used to be the only people that had clients. You know, if you were a lawyer, you had clients, and if you were a doctor, you had patients. Okay.
And
one of the funniest things about that whole rise of the client terminology. The concept of client comes from ancient Rome.
Oh.
And every morning, if you were a member of the patrician class and therefore a member of the Senate of Rome, the conscript fathers of the Republic, you had a certain base of people who acted on your behalf in exchange for your advocacy and sort of protection. So every morning, your job as a Roman senator was to get up, get betogued, and step out into your into the front of your house and meet with your clients. And so your clients were a form of servants. They were a servile class. They came from the equites, the knights, and they came from the plebs, and they were everything but up to and maybe even including the slave class. So the irony of the fact that everybody, all businesses now have clients, is that they are quietly telling us the effing truth, Diane, that we are their damn servants.
Oh, God. So it's come full circle. Come full circle. Well, you know, speaking of irony, I meant to tell you, I was walking around campus when I heard you play that clip of the politician from what, South Carolina?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mr. Ironically named Color.
Oh, God. Well, that's another piece of irony there.
I'm going to vote for the Color fella.
Yeah, right. Well, I was just walking around the track at the end of the day, and in the old stadium that looks like a feudal. It looks feudal around here. The university looks like it should have a moat around it. It's kind of laid out in this feudal way with the walls around it and stuff. You know, well, and all that priestly garb we wear, you know, we are feudal. The whole academic thing is
Well, the whole model is.
It is feudal. It's overtly feudal, and I kind of like it in some ways, but it looks...
What it really is medieval. Because
The
caps and the gowns are all direct hand-me-downs from Oxford and the Sorbonne.
Yeah, okay, well, that's cool, I guess. Good heritage there. But anyway, so I'm walking around the old stadium, which looks like a medieval structure with all these big limestone walls around it. It almost looks, I don't know, in another way, it kind of looks like Camelot, you know.
Sure.
It's interesting. And so I'm hearing you play the clip of the guy from South Carolina, and I hear that train, the train coming through. I about fell on the tracks in front of the people jogging. I was laughing so hard because one thing, it was just funny. Like, he's trying to be a leader, and here comes the train. But I also was thinking, and here's the obligatory reference to Star Trek Next Generation. I was thinking of that episode, I don't know if you saw it, where something went screwy on the holodeck and they kept having the train come through the
Enterprise.
Remember that? So I was walking around this quasi-medieval structure when the marching band was in the middle playing. So it was all kind of, it was all kind of a circus to me, but I'm trying to get my walk in after class, and I'm podcasting you. The big marching band is in the middle doing its thing. There's some of us jogging around, and then you play that, and I just about fell over. I thought that was the
beautiful
funniest thing.
That's just beautiful.
And probably some horn listeners, given there's a you know, a number of them who watch Star Trek, they might have thought the same thing, because once I heard that train and, of course, grasped
Mr. Data, turn the train off.
Then you see Worf shoveling coal and the engine room, you know what I'm saying? And, I just thought it was a nice way to kind of end the day on campus. And then I want to tell you one more thing, but then I want to get off the phone because I don't want to preclude others from calling in, because I know you're going to be gone a couple of nights and you have others who want to talk with you. But one other thing, I wanted to congratulate you on what you did on Up with Chris Hayes, on your interview, your TV interview. It was on Friday night after the series. And you did a nice job. You're to be congratulated. And if I may, I wanted to tell you the one line I loved best that you said.
Oh, I'm thrilled to hear it.
Because I love to watch.
I keep my ego in a little shoebox in the back of the closet. But you know.
No, but it's good when you have a message and you get to say it. I do some interviews. I've done some TV interviews, not in New York on MSNBC, but you know, I kind of sometimes review my interviews to see, well, what came through the best. You know, what could I do differently and stuff like that. I thought I would tell you, there was one line you gave I just thought was stellar. When you said, and I don't think I can say it exactly as you said it, but you said it at the right time, and it came through with like a southern gentlemanly politeness or whatever you call it in the South. You know, I lived in Virginia for a while. There's a nice politeness and genteelness. But then there was a twist of the knife at the end. Oh, you said, well, the politicians in West Virginia had the good manners to stay bought. I about fell off the chair. That was so good.
I got to admit, it was kind of precious.
Was that
because,
off the cuff?
Yeah, it was.
It was brilliant. Think about it.
The common decency to get bought and stay bought.
I like to analyze interviews I would listen to yours anyway, but I also like to, when I'm real interested in the subject, I like to listen to someone who's talking from like a voice of an expert. Boy, when you said that, I just thought it was so well placed.
Well, not to toot my prophetic qualities. But lo and behold, here we are at the end of last week with this new study that comes out that shows that dust off of these mountaintop removal sites induces the growth of lung cancer forming thingies inside cells. And,
yeah.
and lo and behold, you know, we've been through an entire political campaign and neither Democrat nor Republican for Senate or for House nor nothing. None of them will address. I mean, we got two dozen studies now.
Someone should whack them with the 2x4 upside their heads. No, I mean, and that message about the health and how you frame it as a human rights problem and health problem is obviously is just right. But what you said in that one sentence, I mean, I want to tell you it's artful. Because I perceive that listeners to that phrase, you know, they had the good manners to say bought. It was such an artful way of calling them what they are. And yet the listener wouldn't.
Right,
feel,
and we're just haggling about price, right?
Well, I don't think I'm explaining this very well. I mean, sometimes when people are mad and they have an axe, people perceive they have an axe to grind. And God only knows, you all in West Virginia have an axe to grind legitimately. But I'm just thinking of the average listener tuning in, where sometimes if people have an axe to grind, they kind of create some distance between themselves and that person. I don't know why. I don't, but I think that happens. But when you said it that way, it allowed people to grasp what it was without being put off by saying, oh, he's an angry white man or whatever that he might say. I don't know. I thought it was very well done. All the whole thing was well done, but that sentence in particular and the time it came out in the interview, I thought just it was an invitation to listeners to really know what was going on without putting them off with anger. You'd be legitimate to have anger if you would, you know, I wouldn't mind if you had anger, but the way you said that allowed the truth to come through without it being someone being scared of it. I guess that's what I mean.
It was kind of fun because I think it kind of caught Chris off guard a little bit, not in a bad way.
Brilliant. Well, but not too much.
It perked his ears up.
Yeah. Well, it was provocative. It was provocative, and the way you said it, it was like, I just thought, well, it's just the truth lying there in front of everyone, put in such a way.
Well, if anything, it was born of a certain degree of frustration, Diane, because we spend so much time tiptoeing around reality. You know, I want to put the snake-proof boots on and stomp through.
Yeah, you did it with. I would say, like, good manners. I don't know whether you intended to or not, but it's just like a very gentlemanly, mannerly thing. Well, they had the good manners to stay bought. It was like, oh, that, you know how you're always talking about,
Well, if anything, I think I was channeling my mentor, Joe Bagent.
Oh, well, what about, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the name of the person who gives the talks on the Constitution.
Oh, Dr. Bill?
Yeah, you know how you're always talking about, he twists the knife at the end. He brings the axe hammer down at the end.
Yeah, the axe handle, right.
Did that axe handle. You did that at the end of the sentence. You know, because think about it. It's like, well, they have the good manners, so the listener is just like rowing along, you know, just floating down the stream to stay bought. Yeah. I loved it. Anyway, you know, on another night, I'd like to update you on, you know, I told you about the Hollander talk.
Yeah, I saw your email, and I went to the link.
Oh, okay. So I don't know if you're going to have time to watch that, but I would like to, you know, give on another night and I am going to get off the phone so other listeners.
Well, you've got dinner to boil, right?
Pardon? I do have dinner to boil, actually. Exactly. I mean, that's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to boil dinner. It's pasta this time, if you wanted to know. And I'm doing a lot in the crock pot these days, so that's a little, you know, that's a throw a bit of this, throw a bit of that in there. But I'll give you a brief a rundown sometime. And also I mentioned that maybe I asked him if he'd like to talk with a radio program host who has been on MSNBC, you know.
Oh, my.
I know. I threw
oh, my God, we're flying that flag now?
Yeah, I flew that flag. I wanted to get his attention. I ended up not having as much one-on-one time with him as I wanted, and that was my own doing because I crafted his agenda in the College of Business, and one thing I do when I fund a visitor like that is I want to share him with as many people possible. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So I crowded myself out a bit just to make sure he could meet this person and that person and all that. At any rate, I told him about your program and your very intelligent, progressive, you know, listeners, and he gave me an email. He didn't say, he didn't commit on the spot, but he said, well, you could send that information to my assistant, and I have the email, and I can give it to you off air.
Okay.
If you're interested in talking with him.
Oh, absolutely.
Or if you are?
Absolutely.
You are interested? Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I think you know, send that to you off air, and maybe when you have the time, that could work out. So anyway, Bob, I will thank you for another nice conversation, provocative conversation.
Oh, it was lovely as always, Diane.
I depressing in parts, but what the hell? You know, what the hell? It's reality. I don't know.
The nice thing about talking about depressing things among people of goodwill is that it doesn't wind up being overall depressive, because we laugh some and we think about solutions some, and barring that, we just want we'll share recipes and routes to the liquor store.
We have the good manners not to shut down.
We have the common decency not to quit.
I'm gonna use that phrase sometimes. Well, he or she had the good manners not to be around. Something like that. Or to keep his rottenness to himself. Or who knows when that'll pop up. You know how much I have to censor myself so I don't walk around saying Rand Paul and that thing on his head.
Right.
But that's another day. That was the other conversation.
Yeah, or Ted Cruz, son of Raphael. Yes.
Oh, gosh. There's no end to them now. Because these people, you can't just refer to them. They have to have such qualifications. The situation begs for some qualification.
It absolutely does.
Put them in perspective, and we have the good manners to do it that way.
Precisely.
So, you know, there could be other ways. So, okay, Bob, you have a good evening.
Oh, you too, Diane. Enjoy the dinner you boil.
I will. Thanks a lot.
Bye now.
Bye.
Oh, our dear friend Diane in Kansas, Stan, with just delightful conversation. Just delightful. And you might find this interesting, and you can write to me if you want the information. One enterprising, and I'm not saying do this because I'm not the go-do-this guy. We don't do marching orders around here. But one enterprising member of the Horn Family Commune Congregation went digging around for the email address for the head man at MSNBC. And sent off a little email saying, you know, you really ought to bring this guy on, namely me. So if you would like to be part of that process, send me an email to, you know, Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid @gmail.com, or message me on Facebook, or DM me on Twitter, shoot a note to me on Skype. I mean, my God, if you can't reach me, I cannot be reached. And I'll share that information with you. And if you want to, you can get a little a thing going on. You know, who knows? It could happen. Might be fun. Never done that sort of thing. By the way, note coming in from Kate. Just a reminder, because the time draws near. Folks in the Seattle-Tacoma area, people in need of dental, vision, medical, and women's health services who do not otherwise have access to it, if you are one of those people or know one of those people, there will be a RAM USA, a remote area medical clinic, set up in the Seattle-Tacoma area at the Seattle Center, October the 23rd through the 26th. So that would be Thursday through Sunday. More details are available at ramusa.org. And Kate just wanted to make sure that she let me know so I could let you know that resource, that badly needed resource, is available this coming weekend in the Seattle-Tacoma area at the Seattle Center. ramusa.org for more details. And I want to thank both Asa and Kent for jumping in with the fundraising this evening. We are now done with fundraising for the night. Thank you very kindly. It's 14 minutes past the hour, so we got there. We raised the 50 necessary dollars and a little bit more before the end of the program, and that's monumental. If anybody would like to help pick up the slack that will be generated by my unavoidable absence tomorrow and Thursday, I heartily welcome and thank anyone and everyone who chooses so to do. The PayPal interface is under the Contribute tab at headonradionetwork.com. Still need to get the mailing address up there, so I'll repeat it now if you want to go with a check or a money order, with the gentle reminder not to make it payable to Bob Kincaid, but rather to the Horn or Head on Communications, so that it makes it easy for Boss Man Wayne to deal with it when he dons his spider-proof gloves and delves into the dark, echoing recesses of the mailbox. That address is the Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, BECKLEYWV, 25801. Okie doke? Yeah. Let's see, where to go? By the way, I got a note back from Brad on the correction about John Yarmuth. He says there will be a correction on this coming Tuesday's episode since they're taking Thursday off. So, I mean, that's not even necessary. I just wanted to make it plain, make it clear that I wish, honest to God, I wish John Yarmuth was my congressman. But instead, I've got a bunch of people who have had the common decency to get bought and stay bought. Yeah. So, there's that, too. Oh, of course, lines are open. Someone was on hold on the Skype line earlier this evening, hung up somewhere along the way. If you want to jump into the conversation, it's mighty fine, as you can tell, on this Titanic Tuesday, the 21st of October, 2014. By the way, a little reminder. Let's see, tomorrow's 22. Guess what we'll be doing on Friday on the front porch? We will be celebrating. I don't think we've ever had a Friday on the front porch birthday party before. But on Friday on the front porch, this Friday, the 24th of October, we will celebrate the 9th anniversary, if you can imagine it, the 9th anniversary of this program as an online-only entity. You know, we started on February the 2nd, 2004. On October the 24th, 2005, we became internet only, and it will have been 9 years as of this Friday. So I hope we will have a rockin', rollin', freewheeling, hot damn hootenanny hoedown of a 9th birthday party come this Friday. Email coming in from Steve. Steve has $50 he wants to put on the table this evening. Between now and 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific. In other words, the next 42 minutes or so. Steve has $50 he will put forward if there are, if there's, you know, 5 people at 10, 10 people at 5, 2 at 25, et cetera, who will make that happen, who will put forward $50 that he will then match. Again, by the way, if you have any problems with the PayPal interface at headonradionetwork.com, just log into your own PayPal account. And for the recipient address, just use Bob Kincaid, BOBKINCAID, at gmail.com. BobKincaid@gmail.com. And then click the box that says sending money to friends or family. And you won't, and the transfer fees will be waived. So, not Bob at Head On, not Bob Kincaid at Head On, not Bob at Head On Radio Network, not Bob at Head On Radio, BobKincaid@gmail.com. Okay? And thank you, one and all. Where to go now? Where to go? Oh, a little bit of. Oh, darn. I was babbling along, and I didn't realize we were still connected. Hey, Carol.
I can't be expected to follow marvelously coherent Diane.
She was marvelously coherent again, wasn't she? Even while boiling dinner.
I'm telling you, I had the shirts made.
Well, I don't know. We'll make them a premium or something.
We should.
Absolutely. I'm sorry I left you hanging there. I looked over there and I didn't see anybody. I need a keeper.
It was all right. I've been hanging out here for about 45 minutes.
Well, bless your heart.
Oh, I'm not sure how to take that, because usually that means
I would have given you the God love you if it was that.
Oh, okay. Just checking.
Yeah.
Just checking.
God love her.
No, actually.
Have the common sense to hang up. No, that's what that would be. Right. Yeah.
There you go. It was actually kind of wonderful to listen to Diane, because she was touching on so many of the things that I kind of wanted to talk to you about tonight. When did we morph from a country where we disagreed with people's ideas, we disagreed with people's policies, we didn't like their policies, to hating other people?
You know, I hate to blame Appalachia for this, but it is as though the right wing, because I hold the right wing responsible for this. And if we want to sort of trace it, I say that the modern incarnation of most of this filth goes back to Lee Atwater and the Willie Horton campaign.
That's probably true.
And it is as though the right wing took a look at Appalachia and said, "Hey, look at that. They have disagreements over trivial bullshit that they stretch out over a century. Let's do that with the whole country."
Well, and
because isn't red versus blue politics now? Isn't red versus blue politics just the Hatfields and McCoys writ freaking large?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a matter of, I can't just disagree. See, there are people who don't just dislike me because I think it's wrong that kids, 1 in 4 children in our country, go to bed hungry every night. I think it's wrong that people work full-time jobs and don't make enough money to live and survive. I think it's wrong that women in the year 2014 don't have parity in pay. And there are people who look at that and call me a socialist and a communist and all kinds of things. And it's not my ideals that they hate. It's me that they hate. They find out I'm an atheist. And it's not the fact that I don't believe the same thing that they believe that they don't like. They hate me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the story of that judge down in Texas, the justice of the peace, who tells criminal defendants who don't want to pray with him before the court session begins to go stand out in the hall.
Yes.
You know, so that he'll know who to really drop the hammer on.
That's right.
That's right.
And then the Freedom From Religion Foundation wrote him a letter letting him know that that was unconstitutional and unacceptable. And he, of course, became the victimized Christian.
And sent out a fundraising letter.
Yes, sent out a fundraising letter, and there are people I genuinely dislike. I genuinely dislike Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly, because they're the source of so much of the misinformation. But even my fellow Hootervillians, there isn't any of them here that if they knocked on my door and asked me for help, I would help them.
Sure. And that is, you know, that's our essential, I want to say, middle class American decency. And that comes from that place where once upon a time we understood that a community had to thrive in order for individuals to survive.
Absolutely.
That's a remnant of that, Carol. But they're doing their best. They're doing their best to do away with that as well. What was it? A couple of years ago, that the woman knocked on the door and got blown away for her, you know, she was coming home from nursing class and got blown away for her trouble, mm-hmm. or the guy who wrecked his car and was standing out on the road and the cop killed him.
Yes.
Now, bear in mind, both of these people had high melanin content in their skin.
Wrong colored.
Yeah, right. But I don't know if that was sizzle or edge or what, but yeah. But it's expanded. Look at the guy in Florida who turned around and blew away a guy in the movie theater for texting.
Yes.
We have people shooting at other people over losing a game of beer pong now. I mean, don't get me started or I'll go off down this litany of what I call signposts. Remember Rod Serling? There's a signpost up ahead. It's not a signpost anymore, Carol. It's a goddamn series of Burma Shave signs.
Well, you know me. I'm not happy just trying to understand it from the outside looking in. I always have to go there, you know. I had to go to Ferguson in order to understand what was going on there because I don't really trust media.
Mm-hmm.
And I came away from it with a much different point of view.
I got the sense that you came away from it a different person.
I did come away from it as a different person and a person that some of my friends weren't very happy with. Some of my progressive friends weren't very happy with.
Oh, dear.
Because they're truly of the belief that instead of it being a handful of people that are actually burning down buildings and throwing Molotov cocktails, that they're all doing it, and it's just a few who aren't.
But really, Carol, when you're making a judgment like that, these people, isn't that because at their core they wanted to make that judgment? Isn't that another, and I thank our buddy Harry in Baltimore for bringing this so much to the forefront for me. Isn't that a confirmation bias kind of thing? Or a bias confirmation kind of thing?
Sure it is. But, Bob, like 3.5 years ago, I was noticing this social media trend where people were there was this, like, racism that was kind of bubbling just under the surface. And just out of curiosity, you know me, like I said, I've always got to go there. So what I did was I changed my Facebook profile picture to a black woman. And I didn't say anything to anybody. And interestingly enough, I've got like 1,000 and some people following me on Facebook. Not one person said a word or asked what it was about. None of them. I guess I'm that much of a freak, but nobody said anything about it. So
right.
I went ahead and put it up there and then just went on about my business of interacting with strangers on social media. And the interesting thing was, and I had just gotten done reading John Howard Griffin's book, Black Like Me.
Mm-hmm.
Did you read that book?
Yeah, oh yes.
And for those who don't know, back in the fall of 1959, Griffin was a journalist who wrote extensively on the topic of racial inequality. He was really determined to investigate the black experience in the South firsthand. So he consulted a dermatologist who prescribed a course of drugs, sunlight treatments, skin creams, and he transformed Griffin from a white man to a black man, if by appearance only. And Griffin spent several weeks as a Negro in New Orleans and parts of Mississippi with side trips to Alabama and Georgia. He traveled mainly by bus and hitchhiked. And the book described in detail the problems that black men encounters in the South, meeting simple needs like finding food and shelter and toilet facilities. And he described the hatred that he felt from white people that he encountered on a day-to-day basis. And after reading that, I thought, well, I'm obviously not going to go to those extremes. Not that anybody'd ever buy that. I mean, I've got to be with the whitest white person you've ever talked to. But
no, that's me, but I'll, you know, yeah, we'll flip a coin.
Well, yeah, you are kind of scarily more white than me.
I'm a gerator bulb. It's no joke.
You and me both, Don. So in the spirit of John Howard Griffin, I changed my Facebook profile picture to a black woman that I just plucked from Google Images, and I left it there for 2 weeks. And A couple of people knew what I was doing, and I was still a middle-aged 50-something. I just was melanin enhanced, and I didn't change anything about what I was posting or the way I was posting it. But I was really kind of stunned at the reaction from both sides, because there were white people who posted some of the most incredibly insensitive, obviously very racially motivated comments. And when I called them on it, I was instantly accused of playing the race card. And this was before it became popular to accuse white people of playing the race card, because this was right after the president was.
Yeah, that was it was a gotcha. It was a gotcha.
Exactly. So as a white woman, or presumably a white woman, since I've never actually used a photo of myself as a profile picture, I'd never been accused of that before. Now, there were black people who immediately sent friends requests. And in the interest of being ethical, I sent them private messages explaining what I was doing and offered them the option of rescinding their offer to be my friend. And most of them were fine with it, and some of them were deeply offended and rescinded their offer. And I respected that. But I didn't reveal my true identity to anybody else. And there was one white guy who was a real redneck, who I had a real heated interaction with before it was over. He sent me a friend's request. He always addressed me as ma'am. I actually come to like him very much, and I'm absolutely convinced that he's really kind of a product of his upbringing, and that given a chance, he probably wouldn't ever have said some of the things that he said. But never before in the history of our country have we questioned the birthright of our president. We've never had conspiracy theories about anybody's background being so prevalent. And
we've never questioned, at an essential level, Carol, we have never questioned his ability to do presidential things.
No. And people are angry with him because he's not liberal enough, or he's not firm enough on this or that or whatever. And I'm like, the first time he comes off as an angry black man, do they realize what the reaction is going to be? I don't have any issue with people who don't like his fiscal policies. I take no issue with people who don't like his foreign policy. I take no issue with anyone who says that. It's when he's condemned for those policies based on the color of his skin that I get pissed. You know, when
you mean like Phyllis Schlafly, Barack Obama's trying to make America more like Africa through Ebola.
Oh yeah, that is pure race baiting. You know, when he got bin Laden, it took a Muslim to find a Muslim in order to kill bin Laden.
Here's a great example. Our friend Beth in Dallas posted this on my Facebook page the other day, a photograph of some guy's pickup truck down in Louis Gohmert's district, who, by the way, says at least Ebola has kept the Mexicans from coming across the border so much because they're afraid they'll get the Ebola in Texas. But it was a pickup truck that said, does this A**** make my truck look big? As if he was, you know, too Christian to say the word ass. And it showed a picture of Barack Obama with a banana.
So I can be as racist as I want. That's not offensive. But I don't want to say ass because I ain't Christian.
Right. Well, some people commenting on it, though, made the astute observation that could, you know, that's, you know, A**** could be ASS or it could be APE, you know, in light of the fact that there's a banana next to it.
Exactly.
And of course, if you say anything to these types, they say, well, you just want me to be politically correct. And I long ago came to the conclusion that when a right winger complains about political correctness, the right winger is complaining about not being able to say that particularly that particularly hateful word that isn't ginger but uses all the same letters.
Exactly.
And I haven't found anything yet to refute that, Carol.
Well, they get a little upset with me when I find out that the Human Genome Project's been on the case for a very long time. The fact is, we're all black. White people are nothing more than a pale adaptation of our black ancestors who've evolved over the last 140,000 years. And I know that that challenges their fundamental Christian beliefs, along with the idea that the word Earth is, you know,
well, but there's so much truth in that.
And not flat.
Something that I've pointed out that I've never heard anybody else allude to before is that you can find in the roots of evolutionary rejection racism, because without fail, to admit evolution means that within the framework, say, of the one drop rule, you got some black blood in you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being on a boat that was headed due east out of I think it was Brunswick, Georgia, headed to Sapelo Island a couple of years ago. It was a beautiful, beautiful fall day. And at one point, all you could see was ocean in front of you. And my host, I was standing with her in the bow, and she was a person of color. And she looked at me and said, "Yonder lays the mother country." And I looked at her and I simply said, "Yep, the mother of us all," because it was, you know, Africa.
Exactly.
And she was stunned for a moment. She was taken aback, and she said, "Well, you're the first white person I've ever heard say that." Well, how can you not?
Sense of historical awareness.
Well, I mean, I am unaware of Australopithecus whiterensis being excavated in the tundra of Sweden. I mean, it's just a fact. You know, we in the midst of, and I know people are sick of hearing about it, so they're going to have 2 days of not, but in the midst of the Ebola freakout, because, you know, Ebola is going to kill us all, according to Fox News and you know, the rest of the goons. But those who have not studied the progress, if you can call it that, of the human species don't realize that at one point in time, and you're related to them, and I'm related to them, and everybody within the reach of my voice, and everybody on the planet is related to them, the entire human species was down to about 2,000 to 2,500 individuals in a little corner of the forest in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's the folks who went eastward and wound up figuring out the concept of boat and wind up in Australia, or whether it's the people who keep wandering north so long that there's so little sun that they wind up freakishly white, or the people who go on across Asia and cross the land bridge and populate the Americas. We're all coming from that same core group. And if you just take that, you know, if you just take long enough to And then you listen to some Republican saying, "He don't share our values." Oh, shut up. You know? Not yelling at you, of course. I mean, but you get my meaning.
But the truth is, you're black too, buddy.
Well, good.
You're just one of those pale adaptations.
Right. I mean, and I say good, because That means that I am fully vested in the human experience.
Well, it kind of goes back to what I was talking about James Baldwin. I didn't do this, and you didn't do this, but we're all citizens of this country. And so we all have a responsibility to do something about it.
Yeah, and if you sit back and say, "Well, I didn't have a hand in it. I ain't got nothing to do with it. I ain't gonna help." So that means you don't have to try.
Not
you
my
don't,
favorite.
Right. So you don't have to have a hand in solving the problem. You're just gonna sit back and let the rest of us do the hard work. Well, then you're gonna be the anachronism when the rest of us have done the hard work, aren't you? Right.
Exactly. Yes.
I mean, that those people are gonna be the outliers, and I don't even like using the phrase "those people." You people. Oh God! Never mind. I won't go there. I've been.
Well,
I've been. You people more times than I can count, and that's just. Ugh.
Oh, you and me both. I challenge those kinds of statements, though, because in and of themselves, they're bigoted. And if you don't challenge them, then you're complicit. And I won't go there.
Right.
So I get a lot of people angry at me because I challenge everything.
And it, you know, I don't hate
my fellow Gravillians because they're ignorant. Most of them have never been out of the state. Some of them not even out of the county for the course of their entire lives. And I get that when the world is that small, they're likely to see things in a certain way. And people who have a lot of stamps in the passport book tend to see the world with a much broader lens.
And hence kind of what I was saying earlier about geographic education. You remember that scene in It's a Wonderful Life where young George Bailey is getting ready to travel the world? And, of course, George Bailey never gets to travel the world. But he's been reading National Geographic all his life. And he's young George Bailey, and he's got his bucket list. You know, by the time he's 18, he's got a bucket list. Well, the fact of the matter is, even if you don't have stamps in your passport, and my passport doesn't have many stamps in it, I think it's got three. Well, if you have bothered to be even remotely curious about the world in which you live, then you are ahead of the game. Because you are innately going to be less likely to be judgmental. So, you know, you can be a Hootervillian and never have left the front porch of Sam Drucker's store. But if you tried to learn a little bit about the world outside of Hooterville, Hooterville itself for you will be a richer place, will it not?
Of course it will. You know, I was just having this conversation with Barbie this morning. She was saying that I kind of freaked her out when I was a kid because I had a book in mind all the time. And she said, and for somebody who'd never gone anywhere or seen anything or done anything, she said, you had a really broad view of the world. You had a very kind of accepting nature about things that were different from you because books had always taken you to very exotic places, and you had met so many people in your books that you had been traveling in your heart and in your mind and in your spirit for a very long time. So when I actually got to get on the plane for the very first time and leave the country, it was really easy for me.
Yeah. It's exciting. It's not just easy. It's exciting. Oh, goody. I'm going to go see some place that I've read about. And you know
yeah.
what, I think we can even apply that inside the continental United States. I mean, I had a profound cultural experience going to northern Wisconsin, as profound as I've ever had anywhere. But, you know, there are, without getting my colander out and putting it on my head, I think this too is a function of deliberate actions. A people who dare not question authority, a people who live in a state of constant uncertainty about the future, a people who cannot put anything away for a rainy day, a people who will be absolutely ruined by a transmission going out. Well, they don't have the luxury of sitting around like I did with my dad when I was little. I mean, my dad would just pass the time by opening up the Rand McNally Atlas and telling me about his Navy buddy who lived in Douglas, Arizona, and said, someday, son, we're going to get in the car and we're going to go see him in Douglas, Arizona. We never did. Or we were going to go see his buddy in Pocatello, Idaho, and we never did. But we did travel quite a bit. A lot of that travel was the roads between northwest Alabama and south-central West Virginia. But there's a lot of fascinating places between here and there, too. and a lot of curiosity on the part of my father, who was forever saying, "Margaret, I'm going to take a scenic detour." Yes, Kenneth. And away we went. We went to Somerset, Kentucky one time because my father thought Somerset, Kentucky just sounded like a beautiful place to be from.
Exactly.
And so a furnace operator, Carol, mm-hmm. with a high school education, but the curiosity of a doctoral student who drove to Somerset, Kentucky, and just asked the waitress in the diner how wonderful it was to live in Somerset, Kentucky. With all the, you know, with all the earnestness of someone who was thinking about moving there. There was a time when Reynolds thought about transferring him to Wyoming, and he had the whole house was, well, hot damn, let's go. We've never seen Wyoming. And so that's the way I came up.
When I was 4 years old, my parents, and I can't imagine how they came up with the money or managed to do it, but bought a set of World Book encyclopedias.
Oh, the wonders of the World Book.
Yes, so that we kids would have something to do our homework with and research. Well, being the youngest, I was really jealous that everybody else got to go to school. They were all going to school, and I was still at home, and there was this wonderful old Czechoslovakian man who lived across the road, and he taught me how to read. And so by the time I got to kindergarten and everybody else was doing See Dick, See Jane, it was See Carol, Be Bored, because I was in the corner reading Bobbsey Twins, and I was in second.
You and I have a very, very similar shared experience.
Yeah.
We had that same set of World Books, and I was the youngest, and I would, and it just became like a litany or some sort of religious response. One of my siblings or my parents, I would say, "What is or where is or who is?" And they said,
"Look it up.
Look it up." And I spent a lot of my childhood, you know,
hours.
I spent a lot of my childhood just reading, you know, from A to Alabaster.
Yes, I would open it up at random and look at something and say, I'm going to learn everything that there is to know about this thing that I'm looking at right now. And my mother was this genteel Southern belle who was raised in a very affluent area in Texas. And my father came from Iowa peasant stock, generation and generation of Iowa peasant stock. And my mother just had, she was not, I never saw the woman pick up a book or even read a magazine. And I drove her absolutely insane with having to read everything. And I would open up this book and read something. And she'd go, "What are you doing?" And I'd go, "I'm reading about da 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 da." And she'd go, "Why?" And I'd say, "For fun." And she'd go, "You are so weird." And my dad would just look at her and smile and go, "Yeah, but it's a good weird." And
exactly.
I used to get in trouble. I used to get in trouble for reading books all the time. And my sister still asks, she goes, "I can't count the number of times Mom screamed at you, 'Get your nose out of that goddamn book and get down here and do this or do that.'" And that was my punishment, was she would try to take my books away, but she didn't know where I had them all hid. So I was never without a book. But books were my comfort, and they were my solace, and they still are. And that's why I teach kids in the neighborhood who have learning disabilities. That's why I'm so adamant about teaching these kids to read and be comfortable with reading and to learn that it's fun. Because I want them to have that same love. I want them to be able to go on those same journeys. And I want them to meet those same interesting characters and to find themselves so lost in it that they feel like they're a character in the story. So I guess that's weird, but
only within the context of a culture in which curiosity is a character flaw.
You know, I listen to your show every day, Bob, because I learned something from somebody. I learned something from somebody in the chat room. I learned something from one of your callers who calls in. Even Mr. Stress, you know, will talk about baseball from the 40s. And after he gets off the phone, I'll look it up.
Yeah, because
I have this.
Because the curiosity itch has, the curiosity bug has bitten. And, you know, once you've been bitten, if you've been bitten by it once, you're going to scratch it forever.
I'm 55 years old. When am I going to figure out that I got it? Because I never will.
Right. And it, you know, it beat it to me, and maybe we're sounding elitist, but it beats the living bejesus about wondering who's going to make the finals on Dancing with a Millionaire.
Well, they can call me elitist all they want. I grew up as poor as they came, in a huge, religiously diverse family, without heat or electricity. And I mean, we had nothing. We absolutely had nothing. Came from nothing and have made the full circle back to nothing. But, you know, thanks to the economy, but.
You know, there's that great line in Jimmy Buffett's Pirate Looks at 40, where he sings, I made enough money to buy Miami, but I pissed it away so fast, never meant to last.
I kind of was one of those people who thought that it was going to last forever, so I spent what I made. And if I lived half as austerely then as I did now, I'd have enough money to retire on, but... You know, we live in an age.
You had a damn fine time, though, didn't you?
Yeah, I did have a damn fine time. I saw the world and lived in some wonderful places and met some utterly fascinating people, and I don't regret a damn bit of it. But I just want people to know that while there are mouthpieces for the right wing that I dislike, I don't dislike your average teabagger. I actually feel sorry for them because they're so ignorant. And I dislike what they're saying because I know that it's based on misinformation and fear. But I dislike them because once you put all that stuff away, there's another human being there. There's another American there. That is an American citizen. That's somebody that we would fight for. And I guess I have this very idealistic longing for that to come back, for us to stop being so deeply left, right, red, blue, black, white.
Yeah, it gets
liberal, conservative.
It gets brutally exhausting. The culture wars.
It is exhausting, and I feel like right now the middle class is kind of, we're taking it death by a thousand paper cuts. They're attacking us on so many fronts, Bob, that from day to day you don't know what to be pissed off about.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've got a phrase for it here, Carol. You know, outrage fatigue. And that's why I don't take too terribly kindly, you know, if I happen to mention my beloved Mountaineers just putting the beat down on the Baylor Baptists last week. You know, I'll inevitably get an email saying, you know, goddamn football. You know, please. I can't just sit around seething all the time.
I got a good laugh today. Somebody posted something about the girls who root for the San Francisco Giants being pretty, and I said, yes, girls here in Kansas City, we're ugly but we're fierce. and they just laugh. They, you know, you just gotta laugh it off.
Oh, I saw an apology by Will Rivers Pitt earlier today on Facebook, apologizing to everyone who takes issue with him. But he said, "I'm sorry. As a Red Sox fan, I'm rooting for Kansas City. I know San Francisco's a liberal city and Kansas City ain't, but I'm rooting for Kansas City. I just am." And I'm kind of caught here because I was raised. I mean, it was. My mom was the church goer. My dad was the sports watcher and the map reader and stuff. And my dad raised me with a sort of zeal where baseball was concerned. because there was a hierarchy that extended, okay, we rooted for the Reds first and foremost. You want to talk about being a little drop in a sea of aloneness. Yeah, everybody was a Braves fan or a Cardinals fan where I grew up. I think we were the only Reds fans for, you know, counties. We would drive out on Sunday afternoons when he was off. We would drive out on to a high spot where the car AM antenna would bring in the Cincinnati station so he could listen to the Reds play baseball. So I was raised to root for the Reds. By the time I was old enough to pay attention, the Reds were in the NL East. So barring that, we rooted for the NL West winner. But when it came to the World Series and the All-Star game, it was just, there was no question. One rooted for the National League. And then it only got worse once the designated hitter came in, because those people over there in that league had quit playing baseball and were playing something called 10-man or 9.5 guys. So my inclination is to root for San Francisco.
My old man had a gift. He could have a transistor radio earbud in each ear and be watching the game on the television and tell you what was going on. And one of them had been given second. I never had that gift.
My father had selective hearing and a little bit of passive aggression. Once he got a clicker for the first time in 1973, if a conversation in the living room was annoying him, he would just proceed to sit there in his chair and turn the volume up.
My old man never touched a television dial or anything else. He had little channel changers.
Yeah, that's what
all
you,
over the house. Oh,
yes, yes.
Yeah, for him on command.
And that's the way it was until I was 10 years old. and it was August. It was August of 1973, and the first thing we ever watched on the first color TV we ever got, which also happened to be the first remote control, was a Minnesota Vikings preseason football game. Because talk about weird.
Yep.
I decided I was a Vikings fan.
Because it was the first thing you saw?
No. I love the Vikings. And, because, you know, they played those games at, what was it, Memorial Stadium? And, you know, the snow would be 8 feet tall on the sidelines, and they had a freaking flamethrower that cut out the yard markers. And Bill Brown wore short sleeves playing fullback in 20 below weather, and I'm like, God, that's cool. And, you know, we would...
I was from East Iowa, and that just looked like home to us.
Well, yeah, exactly. It didn't have the panache that it had for a kid from Northwest Alabama in a town that declared martial law if 3 flakes of snow fell. So
first time I went to Arkansas, there were 2 inches of snow on the ground. They closed the whole town down, and I sit there going, I got pulled over by a state trooper for driving too fast.
Oh, the people I grew up with, if it snowed more than an inch or so, they made ice cream out of the snow.
Yeah, I had Illinois. I was like, officer, do you see my plates? He goes, yeah, I know, you're from Illinois. He goes, but you're scaring the hell out of everybody. And he let me go.
Oh, Carol, we got to get out of here, dear, but this has been a lovely conversation.
It has. You have a great night, Bob.
All right, going to try. We'll talk soon. Friday on the front porch.
Take care.
All right, bye now.
Yes.
Our buddy News Ninja, Carol Baker. And we are out of here. By the way, we closed the program. Thank you very kindly to Jack and to Glenn. We closed the program only $20 away from meeting Steve's $50 challenge. So that's good. Hopefully that'll happen in the next few minutes. And we closed the program having met, thanks to a combination of Joan and I'm sorry, I have to go back through here. Kent and Asa, having met the evening's fundraising goal. So thank you, one and all. We'll catch you Friday on the front porch, our 9th birthday. Thanks, everybody. Sheena, it's all for you. Y'all have a good night. Bye now.